Hello, Dominic in Amsterdam.
Hello, Katie in Paris.
That's a very serious opening. Made us sound almost like newsreaders or serious journalists.
That always happens when you open it.
That's because I am a serious journalist.
Yeah, unlike me.
Unlike you, but you are a serious opera singer. I really liked that video that you posted on our Facebook page of yourself in action.
Oh, thanks.
I really liked the slow-mo shot of your colleague running across the stage in slow-mo. I thought he looked really dreamy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the camera people were just following him all day, and there were like a few times when I thought I was doing something really good on stage, and I was like, for Pete's sake, they're not even watching me. Anyway, it's been touch and go today, hasn't it, about whether this recording would actually happen, because...
Oh my goodness.
Quite a lot of drama in Amsterdam with the electricity, and at this point of listening, there are still 20,000 houses without any electricity due to a storing, an outage that happened just around the corner. I think there was like a fire and an explosion. Sorry, I realised I sound really blasé about that. There was just a fire and an explosion.
It's just a small explosion.
But should we introduce the podcast? Who we are? Like, we might have some new listeners.
Well, I'm Katie. I am a journalist in Paris.
And I'm Dominic. I'm an opera singer in Amsterdam. And we are two old friends from the UK living on the continent. And we call each other each week and talk about fascinating things that are going on.
And because after 14 weeks, we're getting a bit bored of each other's company, we also call up other people from all over the continent who are doing all kinds of interesting things. So far, we talked to German interpreters whose job is to translate Donald Trump, which is, as you can imagine, quite a tricky business. And we've talked to, who else have we talked to?
The leader of a new pan-European progressive party.
We have. We've talked to an IKEA designer. We've talked to an ethicist who specialises in the ethics of organ transplants. We talked to all kinds of people.
We've spoken to most people in Europe now, so I mean, yeah. We're scraping the barrel. But fortunately, we've got two wonderful guests this week. First, we'll be speaking to Jennifer Pettersson, who is a Swedish journalist living in Amsterdam, who has her own podcast that's been very successful over the last few weeks called Opgejaagd, meaning, I think, hunted, although I might ask her for a better translation. And it's about her conflict within herself as to whether to move back to Sweden because she's finding the education system for her children so disappointing.
So we're going to speak to Jennifer, and then we are going as northerly as we've ever been, actually, on this podcast. We're going to Svalbard, way out past the Arctic Circle, to visit Norway's global seed bank, basically where the world keeps a backup of all of its seeds in case of a nuclear apocalypse, which is nice and cheery.
Whoop, whoop.
We're going to be speaking to its boss, Åsmund Asdal, about what it's like to prepare for that kind of disaster as a job. So really, this episode is about the sort of youth and hope of the next generation, but also doom and destruction. Yay!
Yay! Did you celebrate International Women's Day yesterday?
Celebrated it by working. Sadly, I didn't join the Spanish strike because you don't live in Spain.
No, that would be why you didn't, and that's very sensible.
But your sister joined it, didn't she? Your sister in Madrid?
My sister was marching, yeah. I don't know if she actually stroked.
That's not the past tense of that verb.
Striked. I wish it was. I'm going to campaign to have that in the European English Dictionary, which we talked about last week. Go back and listen if you haven't already. But I woke up to some news today, which I guess could be seen as quite good progress for women in a kind of roundabout way. They're looking for a new CEO in Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport, and they are specifically looking for a man.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, you might be like, let's boycott the airport because this doesn't sound like progress. But actually, the reasoning is because they want to have a balance of genders at the top of the company. And currently, there's a 50-50 gender split amongst the company's top four employees. And they want to keep that. What do you think about that?
I see. So they're replacing him. They can't replace him with a woman because there'd be too many women.
Exactly.
Wow. What an amazing situation to be in.
Yeah, but also, I kind of think, are we at a stage where we should be discouraging women for applying for any top jobs, considering that like men have held these positions forever?
Yeah, that doesn't seem quite right, does it?
No, it doesn't. But then also it's kind of nice because this CEO who's stepping down, he was the one who brought in the 50-50 split, I believe. And he's really pushed for women's rights. So the fact that he's now saying, I need to be replaced by a man is kind of ironic.
It is a sort of refreshing irony. Does this policy only apply to the top of the people that work at Schiphol Airport or is it for everyone?
Don't know. Because if it goes down to the bottom, it's like this inclusion rider that Frances McDormand shouted about at the Oscars last week.
What a great week to be a woman. Actually, it has. It's been a great week to be a man. Good week to be a man in the Netherlands. Okay, so last week you had the honour as a professional singer of doing a Good Week, Bad Week jingle. And this week I think it's my turn to shine.
Go ahead.
Good week, bad week. How's that?
I mean, it was just as good as mine last week.
Good week, bad week.
Oh, there we go.
There we go.
So who's it been a good week for, Katie?
It has been a good week for young Europeans because the European Union got the ball rolling this week on a plan to give up to 30,000 teenagers a free Interrail pass once they turn 18 so they can go travelling all over Europe by train in the summer. For people listening outside Europe, which I believe is quite a lot of you, Interrail is a train ticket that allows you to take pretty much any train in 30 countries around Europe.
Fake news.
Fake news? Oh no, I got this off the website. Why is it fake?
Well, I did an interrailing trip when I was 18 with 9 friends from school and we had to pay surcharges for like, I think 90% of the trains we took.
90%?
Yeah, and some of them were expensive and some of them you had to book in advance. So it wasn't just this like dream of hopping on and off the train. Maybe we were just really unlucky and maybe things have changed since then because that was a while ago now.
Man.
Yeah, also it was the worst holiday ever. No offense, friends listening.
Why? What happened?
There were just too many of us and well, most of us all like fell out and it was just, I've never had a holiday like that.
A group that big is quite difficult because all of you want to do different things.
Exactly, especially when you're 18 and you all don't have any money and you've never been travelling before. It was a mistake. But if the Interrail pass is free, then that's incredible.
This is the unlimited monthly pass that they're going to be giving away to all these 18-year-olds, which is worth €510.
Whoa.
So I don't know, maybe things have changed a little bit since you did your trip, but it does seem for €500 you should, in theory, get quite a lot of train journeys there.
Yeah, it was nothing like that much money when I got it, so...
Oh man, I'm sad that you had such a bad experience, because this thing has really got kind of cult status, it feels like.
I know.
Interrail launched in the 70s, and definitely in Britain, before taking a gap year, it became like the cliched thing to go and do to find yourself. There was Interrail, and kids would go and get this train pass, and then turn up drunk on the streets of, I don't know, Amsterdam, or Bratislava, and it was a wonderful cultural experience.
It's where the reputation of horrible, drunk British kids came from.
I know we don't talk about the B word on this podcast, but after the B word happens next year, presumably British 18-year-olds won't have access to the scheme.
Oh, yeah.
So it might be a lot more orderly and well-behaved.
Along with the free data roaming charges that British people have really got used to lately, I think that's going to be something that really stings.
Yeah, I think so, because it is going to be really fun. Initially, the EU's only going to do this as a trial scheme, because obviously there's way more 18-year-olds than 30,000. But they're going to spend €12 million on it. And it's not really clear yet how they're going to pick the people that get the tickets, but probably it's going to be some kind of lottery system. But what they have said is that they want to give an advantage to people from low-income families, which is nice.
That is nice.
And it says in the EU budget that this scheme is aimed at better connecting young people with European identity and raising awareness of the EU's core values. Which I think is nice. It's like a really nice way to discover the continent.
Sounds just like our podcast.
It really does, except with this. There's a possibility to fall in love with like a dreamy Italian or a sexy Spaniard on the way.
Katie, you can't just like go to those stereotypes of sexy Italians.
Sorry, sexy Belgians?
Bulgarian.
Sure. I do actually think this is quite astute thinking on the part of Brussels, because if the whole European project in general is going to survive, then obviously you need to make the next generation care about Europe and see themselves as Europeans. And I think that we have this tendency as Brits to assume that the younger generation are really super pro-European. But there is actually quite a strong Eurosceptic streak running through millennials when you look at the wider continent.
Yeah, that's true.
There was a survey by this German company, TUI, last year, which showed that actually 21% of young Europeans prefer their countries to leave the EU.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about this week as well, because I read an article about the Italian elections saying that a majority of young voters had voted for Eurosceptic parties in the Italian election, which really surprised me. And I guess maybe it shouldn't.
Who has it been a bad week for, Dominic?
It's been a bad week for time in Europe.
Time, how existential.
Literally, time has been going like a tiny bit slow since mid-January.
Feels like it.
Yeah. They in fact think that the digital clocks have slowed down by up to 6 minutes since mid-January, which is quite a lot actually when you think about it. Imagine what you could have done.
Soft boil an egg.
Yes, one egg. No, hard boil an egg for 6 minutes.
Anyway,
okay, I'm going to have some complicated words coming up, so brace yourself, Katie.
I am in the brace position.
It's not affecting the whole of Europe, but just the large part of Europe that's interconnected by this large electricity grid. That wasn't actually the complicated word. That operates at a synchronized frequency. And this includes much of mainland Europe. The frequency helps regulate the timekeeping in digital clocks, oven clocks, etc. But not actually mobile phones or laptops.
So my microwave and my oven are going to be out of sync, but my phone isn't. Is that it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the reason for this fluctuation is that the frosty relationship between Kosovo and Serbia led to a little bit of an awkward standoff where Kosovo needed a bit of extra electricity and Serbia refused to provide it, and therefore some energy had to be sapped from like the general electrical juices. I mean, I'm really not the person to be talking about this because I don't understand electricity.
All I understand is that the clocks are slow.
Yeah, and it's something to do with Serbia and Kosovo.
Right.
Let's go to school, Katie.
Let's go back to school.
We are going to call up a Swedish-Dutch journalist, Jennifer Pettersson, who has her own podcast that's been doing very well here in the Netherlands called Opgejaagd, which stemmed from an article that she wrote in the NRC a few years ago, where she like basically listed some of her gripes about early years education in the Netherlands. I found it really funny to hear that there was this podcast about how bad it is bringing a child up in the Netherlands, because in the UK, there are all these articles and even like a book about how to bring your child up the Dutch way. And it's before I moved here, everyone was like, oh, it's got such a good education system.
Yeah, I'd read exactly the same thing from a UNICEF report back in 2013, happiest kids in the world, with Sweden back in fifth place. But it should be noted that that study was based on like a whole range of things like child poverty, housing, whether the kids are living in polluted places. What Jennifer's been looking at is much more closely based on the education system itself. And like any other mother, obviously looking to do what's the best thing for her kid. But it's been quite interesting doing a little bit of research around what Jennifer's been working on, because it's made me realise what a huge variety of teaching philosophies we have in Europe. In France, where I live, there's a lot of rote learning, and kids often complain that school is boring, that it's not fun, that it's very stressful. And that seems to be a completely different approach from what they have in quite a lot of Scandinavian countries, where there's a lot of emphasis on play and learning to love learning. Finland in particular is always like held up as a kind of example of this. They have no formal lessons in maths and reading and things like that until they're 7 years old. And really until then, there's a lot of emphasis on just getting outside, rough and tumble, playing around. And it sounds really fun, really. And quite weird, I think, to parents, certainly in Britain, where we have a tendency to teach our kids. The idea that education is a competitive thing, I think, is brought in quite early, which made me a little bit sad.
Yeah, it is sad. And they're such important years for like setting up how you learn and how you work and whether it can be a thing that you enjoy or a thing that you dread. So it'll be interesting to speak to her to find out what she's discovered comparing the education in Sweden and Netherlands.
Hello?
Hi!
Hello, how are you?
I'm just a bit nervous to speak English.
Oh.
What? Come on, your English is amazing like every other Swedish person we've ever met. But Jennifer, tell us how you ended up in the Netherlands, because you've been there for a long time now, right?
It was meant to be a year at the art school in Amsterdam, but it went as it went, and I'm here now for 20 years. I got married, I have kids.
It sounds like my story, Katie. I also came here to study, but at the Opera Academy, and now I'm stuck here and married.
You make that sound like a bad thing.
Yeah, no, it's not. Well, maybe it is a bad thing. that's kind of what your podcast is about, isn't it?
Yeah. I always felt at home in Amsterdam. I always loved Amsterdam. It's a beautiful city, and the people are great. They have some other qualities than Swedes that I really appreciate, that Dutch are direct.
Yeah.
Swedes are totally not. They're very afraid of conflict. But then when I got kids, actually that feeling of feeling at home here changed quite dramatically.
I was quite surprised to hear that you were finding it disappointing to be a parent here in the Netherlands, because in the British press, we all hear that the Netherlands is such a perfect place for children. Do you think it's partly that Sweden is even better and that the Netherlands just hasn't quite clocked on? Or do you actually think it's over-egged how good the Netherlands is for education?
There are many things that surprised me. Since I was expecting Holland to be a modern country, they seem very similar to Sweden in many ways. But the whole view on little children and how to take care of them is completely different from Sweden. You take your 10-week-old baby to daycare here, which in Sweden would be forbidden, in a crib all day long, personnel that is so used to the sound of crying that they don't even hear it anymore. And with such a work pressure that they don't have time to be with the kids, but they're busy with all the tasks around, running the daycare center.
That situation that you just described, putting really young babies into creches, that sounds really familiar to me living in France, where, I've got colleagues who've had to do exactly that, like put their babies straight into the creche very young so that they can go back to work. How does Sweden get around that problem? Is it simply a question of having really good maternity leave?
Yeah, there's a very generous maternity leave in Sweden. It's 480 days for both partners. So they make sure that the man is also at home with the kids. The bond with the parents is much stronger. The Swedish government spent 8 times as much money on small kids as the Dutch government.
Wow.
It's a lot. Then I was quite frustrated after also having cleaned the classroom, because there's no money for cleaners. Not at all schools, but at many schools, that's pretty normal. I even heard of parents who clean the toilets, parents who paint the classrooms.
So, sorry, you went in and cleaned the classroom yourself?
Yeah.
Wow.
That sounds crazy. And I think we'll probably shock a lot of people who don't think about the Netherlands as a country where parents would have to do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The thing I find really interesting about all of this is that the Netherlands actually does better than Sweden in terms of there's something called the PISA tests, the main method that we use to internationally rank different education systems against each other within the kind of developed world. So the Netherlands comes out higher, but it's obviously not working for you as a school system. Have you decided, even with the higher test scores, you'd really rather not keep your kids there in the Netherlands?
I'm really looking for another solution, but I have one problem, and that's my husband. He's always lived in Amsterdam all his life, and he has all the time relativized the problems, mm-hmm. just as many parents do in Holland. But now he's actually changing his mind. He's also listening to the podcast and helping me with it. So now we have actually been in Sweden together to look at the school, but we're also looking here at different alternative schools. But many of those alternatives in Holland, they cost a lot of money.
When they could be free in Sweden for the equivalent things. I was wondering, could you tell us about some of the great things that Sweden do right? I've heard there's something about spending time outside for kids at school.
They spend loads of time in the forests and they do projects there. The kids of my sister, they spend one day a week solely in the forest. So they brought warm food to the forest.
That's amazing.
The ratio kid grown up is 1 on 5. Here is 1 on 30. So there is much more possibilities what you can do. They even do laboratory experiments with small kids. No, yeah, that sounds really crazy. But water rockets. They're growing things. While in Sweden, they're learning a lot about the world around them. From 6-year-old here, you basically only busy with cognitive things like reading and writing and mathematics. And I talked to some experts here in Holland, and when they described how they would like to see preschool or primary school for young children, actually exactly what they described is what I saw in Sweden. To have a very inspiring environment for them where they can explore themselves, and that the grown-ups tag on to what the kids are interested in and stimulate them in that, instead of coming with lessons from above saying, now we're going to learn about the numbers. The most of what they did was getting disciplined, sitting still all day long. Just recently, I interviewed a 7-year-old who seemed to have almost a burnout. She was so stressed from school because always lagging behind and with her homework. And this was an intelligent kid. Both my daughters, they dislike school.
Have you come up against any resistance from Dutch teachers or any parents who feel quite defensive about how things are done here?
I was ready to flee the country when I was going to launch the podcast because I thought now the shit is going to hit. But it didn't happen. I just get wonderful letters and people who think it's great what I'm doing. And I get a lot of letters from teachers, ex-teachers, psychologists. So not only parents, but also professionals.
Is there anything, Jennifer, that you found has actually been done better in the Netherlands?
Yeah. What I recognized in Sweden, which I think is such a pity, is that grown-ups have a problem with putting boundaries to small children. I saw, for instance, in Sweden, how kids were rolling in the dirt and the mud, completely covered. And then the teachers didn't know how to deal with it. They were like, yeah, we really want them to have fun and be free.
Man, poor parents.
Yeah. One mother had to come with clean clothes, thinking, Jesus, yeah, there is a simple word called no. And Dutch parents know this. You know, they know how to put clear boundaries because they're so direct. You should have a kind of a mix of the two.
So, Dominic, where are we going to send our kids to school? Our babies that we're going to have together?
We are not having babies.
We already have a baby in the form of this show, which we are nurturing and loving, as many people would their own children. Moving swiftly on, since we've been talking about Sweden, why don't we hop across to Norway?
I think it's a bit more than a hop, Katie, isn't it?
It is more than a hop. We are going very, very far north to Svalbard, which is a group of islands 1,300 kilometres north of the Arctic Circle. It is halfway between Norway and the North Pole. You might have heard of Svalbard, actually, if you've read the Philip Pullman novels.
That's why I know it. I was just thinking, why do I know that name?
It's the place with the talking polar bears.
Yes, cool.
Which aren't real, I checked.
Oh, not cool.
But what they do have is the Global Seed Vault, which actually kind of looks like something a bit out of a Philip Pullman fancy novel. It's this massive concrete underground bunker hidden in an old mine shaft, which was set up by the Norwegian government a decade ago to prepare us for a nuclear apocalypse by keeping stock of all the seeds that we might need after the world all gets screwed up. Isn't that nice?
It's really cool. I've just read a book about a nuclear apocalypse called On the Beach by Neville Shute from the 1960s.
That sounds cheery.
It's actually not as gloomy as you would think. It's set in Melbourne and like basically the rest of the world has already been killed by the radioactive cloud and they're waiting for it to come. And it's really interesting. They in that book talk about the crops and what they're planting. They talk as if they're not going to die in a month, even though they know they are.
Well, they must have paid a visit to the Global Seed Vault.
Well, they must have. But will there be anyone left to take the seeds out? Did you ask him that?
No, but I probably should have done. This is why you should have done the interview with me.
I'm really sorry I wasn't able to join you on this interview, but...
Dominic wasn't there. Apparently he was singing or something.
Sorry.
Which seems like a poor excuse. It's a really cool project, though. It's got tens of thousands of samples of seeds, the grain and rice. It kind of looks like the world's fanciest organic supermarket kind of thing.
And they actually had to use some of the seeds from it recently, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They used them for the first time in 2015. So basically the way that this thing works is that there are actually seed banks all over the world, like 1,400 different seed banks, doing pretty much the same job, which is something that I never knew. And the idea of this one in Norway is that this is like the global overreaching one, where if there's a problem with one of the like more local seed banks, then they can go to this one to kind of replace the seeds. The place in Norway got used for the first time in 2015 to create new seed banks in Morocco and Lebanon for sort of North Africa and the Middle East, because the region's existing one was in Aleppo in Syria, which has obviously been very badly damaged by the war. So yeah, we've seen it in action already. I rang up the Seed Vault's coordinator, Osman Asdal, just to find out what it's all about, really. I kind of imagined him guarding the Seed Vault in Svalbard with his bare hands, but he's actually based in a nice warm office in Grimstad in the south of Norway and coordinates its work from there. And I started by asking him why the Seed Vault is based all the way up in the Arctic Circle in the middle of nowhere.
Why Svalbard? It's permafrost there, so seeds remain frozen also without extra cooling system.
So there's no extra cooling system at all up there?
Yes, the permafrost offer temperatures between -3 and -4 degrees. Optimal conditions for conserving seeds is about -18, and that is the temperatures that GenBank use for conserving seeds. So there is extra cooling in the seed vault, bringing the temperatures down to -18. Other reasons for having this in Svalbard is that there is quite good infrastructure there with all kind of public services. It's an airport there. It's a fairly remote and safe place. I think most countries all over the world, they have a kind of confidence in Norway. They trust that Norway will take good care of the seeds and will not abuse the genetic resources and so on. So in all, I think Svalbard is the best place to have such a facility.
Can you give me a brief history of seed banks in general? Like, who was the first person to come up with the idea that maybe it would be a good idea to keep some copies of seeds safe just in case of disaster?
Nikolai Vavilov, a scientist in St. Petersburg, he was considered to be the pioneer in conserving seeds of crops. He traveled all around the world and collected seeds from farmers, from breeders, from researchers. He established a huge seed collection in St. Petersburg, which still is one of the world's largest gene bank collections. And slowly the idea of having national gene bank was established all around the world, and more countries established gene banks. And the Nordic countries decided to have a common Nordic gene bank. And this was established in 1979. It was a bit too late, actually, because a lot of genetic material disappeared from farming and from researchers during this period. But of course, a lot of material was conserved and is now available for breeding and research and for developing new varieties for future food production and farming.
So 2 years ago, there was a bit of a leak at the seed vault, wasn't there? And some water got into the entrance. If I understand this correctly, this is because the permafrost started melting. That's pretty worrying, isn't it?
Since the beginning, when snow has melted, we had water intrusion into the entrance tunnel. So this was actually not something new. And it has been discussed all through the years to improve this. But it is correct that in the autumn 2016, we had heavy rainfall in Svalbard and more water than before came into the tunnel. And after that, it was decided that something has to be done with this. So now the Norwegian government has allocated 100 million Norwegian kroners to make a waterproof tunnel into the seed vault. And yes, it is correct that this has something to do with climate change. It has been quite warmer winters in Svalbard recent years, and it was expected that permafrost would re-establish around the tunnel. That didn't happen, and then water is coming into the tunnel, and now we have decided to make a completely new tunnel, which is 100% waterproof and give more security to the seeds, even if there are no staff in Svalbard.
So threats to the protection of the world seeds and plant species include war, as we've already seen with the seed bank in Syria, and climate change, which itself appears to be having an effect on even the permafrost that's keeping the seeds up in Svalbard cold. There are frequent warnings about threats to the world's biodiversity. Do you worry that people are going to be calling on your services more and more in the years to come?
There are hundreds of gene banks all around the world, and they take care of the seeds in the first place. So the seed vault is actually only an extra security. It's like insurance. It's good to have, but you hope you will not use it. Of course, we hope it will not happen, but I would not be surprised if other gene banks face the same problems. It's an unstable world, and hopefully not, but of course, I will not be surprised if it happens.
Fingers crossed, eh? And final, quite silly question, I guess, but when you hear politicians in America and North Korea making all these nuclear threats, does it make people at the seed bank a little worried that the chance of them having to get used is higher?
That's a difficult question, but it's very nice to see that inside the seed vault we have seeds from North Korea, from South Korea, from United States. So even if it's an unstable world outside, inside the seed vault, these conflicts are cooled down literally, and all these countries having conflicts, they cooperate in this task, and the seeds are safe. Even if a nuclear bomb should hit Svalbard, the seeds are so deep stored inside the mountain, so they will be safe.
So this week's happy ending comes from an American. Gus Dolding of New Orleans, who was very angry that Norwegian Air were charging him 120 euros to change the name of a passenger from Bill to William. I mean, it's basically the same name, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm on Gus's side.
It was especially annoying considering that Norwegian Air had changed the time of the flight since his booking. And so he felt like, you've changed the flight time, so why can't I change the name? So most of us in this situation would like ring up customer service line and get angry with the poor customer service assistant at the other end of the line. But Gus, he had another idea. He decided to write a slightly grumpy poem in verse, of course, on Facebook, tagging the airliner. It ended with the stanza, "Why can't you be fair, Norwegian Air? Just skip that amendment fee and just let us change it for free."
Oh, the rhythm's a bit off, but I like it.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the meter, but it's a nice sentiment. And he also is kind of sweet in it. Earlier on, he says, like, "I know I made a mistake, I shouldn't have, but it would have been really nice if you change it." Obviously rhyming, I'm not quoting verbatim. Anyway, Norwegian Air responded with their own poem.
Oh, yeah?
And they waived the fee, and their poem ended with, "We are sorry for any inconvenience that may have occurred. It can seem like our vision is sometimes blurred, but I can promise you that we try to fly like a bird."
That's beautiful. There's some really underpaid poets in their marketing department.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Europeans. You can find us on Twitter, which is Europeans Pod. You can find us on Instagram, which is Europeans Podcast. And our email is europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
And we're on Facebook. Just type in The Europeans Podcast and you'll find us right there.
Thank you also to our one-man jingle factory, Jim Byrne, and to our wonderful guests,
Jennifer Pedersen in Amsterdam and Åsmund Asdal in Gramstad.
Till next week, do we?
Bye.
Do you have any Swedish tongue twisters that you could give us? We put them after the credits.
Sju sjösjuka sjömän från det sjunkande skeppet Shanghai.
Oh, hang on a second. We've already had that one.
Have we?
Yeah, that's the one we got from Sarah Forker, the IKEA designer.
Oh, yeah. What does it mean?
Is it something to do with 7-6 sailors?
Yeah, on the same ship, Shanghai.
I speak Swedish, I can't believe I recognised that.